sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Movement.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression. Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solidarity.
You fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings. With me today is my co-host Gordon Barnes and special guest Ahmed Sabawi, who has been working on a video that examines the impact of the recent 51-day war on the people of Gaza. Welcome, Gord and Ahmed.
Thank you.
Yeah, special welcome, Ahmed. We're really grateful of you taking the time today to share your experience from your travels and what you're working on and the project you've been so devoted to in the last several months. At the end of the 51-day war, ended late August of 2014, Amnesty International indicated that there were over 2,104 Palestinians, mostly civilians, including 495 children at that point in time who had been killed by the Israeli and Hamas conflict, the ceasefire that happened has been at times fragile. Of the 71 killed on the Israeli side, 6 were civilians, including 1 child. And these are United Nations figures, by the way. There were extensive bombing of and attacks on high-rise buildings that housed dozens and dozens of families, as well as commercial offices in Gaza. And I know you've been very committed to telling the story and sharing the information since you've been able to travel in that area, and you were watching it from a distance during the conflict, but had an opportunity to travel and interview people, and maybe you could just sort of share a little bit about your travels, and then we'll be able to hear directly from the people that you talked to and when you were traveling in Gaza.
Yeah, first of all, I have to mention that my connection to the story has got another family dimension, whereas my mom is still living in Gaza. She's 79 years old. And I, during the war, I was all the time trying to get hold of her, and sometimes I managed to talk to her, sometimes not. And as your listeners know, that this kind of war, especially the last one on Gaza, is just targeting randomly everywhere, here and there, and a lot of buildings being hit and totally destroyed, apartment buildings, compound, and mainly civilians. So my mom and actually most of those elderly people, they are in some ways stuck. They don't understand where to go, and there's no shelters in Gaza. There's no safe place at that time. So it was really a very tough time and very hard experience. So my mom has to go to the hospital and being hospitalized and etc. So I felt that civilians being really in the middle and being really suffering a lot in the last war in Gaza. So I decided to do a video about the impact of this war on civilians and how they've been really coping with those kind of impact on them.
So you traveled there from sometime in September then, and were there for a few months, and you interviewed a lot of different people. You talked to children, to adults who had lost family members. You talked to human rights activists and church leaders, and maybe you could share a little bit of detail about that in terms of some of the people we're going to be hearing from.
Yeah, after the ceasefire, which is, I remember the ceasefire being achieved through some regional power and the United States and some other United Nations and, you know, the international community, they managed to bring together, you know, into that kind of 51 wars. And there was some kind of hope that this war will come to the end, and maybe the borders will open, and the, you know, people start to move from here to there. So I decided late September, which is after almost 3 weeks of the war and 3 weeks of that kind of ceasefire, I decided to go and first visit my mom and be with her with this kind of very hard experience, and also talk to the people and interview many different ages, different kind of people. So I did meet with some human rights activists, and I did meet with the doctors, and I did meet with the students, I did meet with the Muslims, Christians, leaders, and activists who are really just caring about the civilians and caring about the people, and how this kind of wars has really deeply affected them and interrupt their own daily schedule, interrupt their own, actually, a kid's life in a ways that it's affect them. And actually all of them insisted that that kind of effect is really for a long time, because being traumatized by these wars and by the missiles and by being caught in the middle and by having no shelter, nowhere to go, no safe place, even some shelters run by United Nations organization work there on that area, UNRWA, is being hit and been, you know, bombed by some of that Israeli airplane or whatever. So there was really a very traumatized time for the population over there. And I hope I managed to capture all that in my video and put it together to the way that to explain what is really going on in terms of the civilian background and what the civilian situation on this in this recent war.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've put together some of the audio from part of the video, and we're going to listen to some of that now, and then maybe we'll have a few comments before the end of the first half hour. So let's listen to that audio now, and then we'll talk about it when it's done.
We are in Beit Hanun area, and this is a residential area, those buildings called Abraj al-Nada. It's been completely destroyed by the Israelis in the last assault on Gaza. And many of those families who've been displaced still looking for shelters, still looking for a place to stay. And many people actually totally displaced and totally hopeless after those kind of building being destroyed. In Gaza, people are still looking for their own personal belonging. In Shija'iya neighborhood, people try to get anything out of their own destroyed houses. Ahjara. Yeah. Hadi baytak hada?
Hada bayt.
Kam wahed kan sakin fi yan?
10 kunna qa'd.
In Gaza, destruction everywhere.
For the last 20 years, I think Gaza was in the eye of the storm. Since Oslo Accord were signed till today, the harvest of 20 years of so-called peace, obvious. It's a state of social economical suffocation of Gaza Strip. And Gaza ended up with criminal, illegal, inhuman siege, sort of collective punishment, and should be ended, swiftly, immediately, completely and not partially. But it seems this criminal siege, which Israel, with the support of the Quartet, imposed on Gaza, was not enough to cripple Gaza, to de-develop Gaza, to make Gaza almost like animal farm, dumping to it some food and medicine by international community.
Here is some of the people who used to live in one of those houses, now staying in a tent. We are going to talk to them about what happened.
وانا بالنسبة لي لحالي كان عندي 27 واحد وهذا 20 نفر بسكن فيه. في منا في المدارس, في حتى مدارس تابعة للحكومة ونقلونا على الأنروا, مدارس الوكالة.
Simply speaking, Gaza should be a special case in the human history. In such small, tiny, poor place was subjected to 7 years of blockade, where nobody was allowed to go out or to come in. Gaza was subjected to 3 wars in 5 years, where many people were killed, thousands were injured, thousands of houses were destroyed.
political situation and its psychological consequences does not submit the normal criteria of trauma. When you talk about trauma, usually the criteria says that post-traumatic stress disorder. Post doesn't exist in Gaza. Since we were born in Gaza, since 48, and what we learned from our parents, grandparents, always we live in trauma, traumatic events. So we call it on-traumatic stress disorder, not post. Parents, grandparents, till now. So we cannot talk about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The trauma is still on. I can give you an example, not so far. Within 6 years, this is the third Israeli offensive attack against Gaza.
Gaza itself is the largest concentration camp on earth. According to Beit Salem, mainstream Israeli human rights organization, Gaza has become the largest open-air prison on earth. And I think the only just solution that can be offered to the refugees of the Gaza Strip, to about 5 to 6 million Palestinian refugees living in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, in refugee camps, is the a secular democratic state. The two-state solution does not offer them a solution, in fact. But I think that Israel's oppression of the Palestinians, and it's not a cycle of violence, it has been a process of colonization and ethnic cleansing since 1948.
Desire of the life, fighting the death, okay, the challenge. We talk about the relation between the Phoenix and the city of Gaza. It's the resurrection of this bird from the grave. It is Zawiya market in Gaza. It's a historical market. It was beside the mosque, and it is the root of the city. It is well known that the Islamic city was contained of the mosque, and beside the mosque it was the market.
During the war, we had a hit. They bombed close to us. There is a school, the school of Manara, and there is our cemetery. Just from here, when we're sitting, just 100 meters. So they hit by bombs, and they hit once, twice, three, five times. Five bombs was coming. So we have so many problems, many damages in the here in the building, in the roof of the church, in the cemetery. You can see the caves and all these things.
This is my last year in school, and I'm going to study maybe law in the university. Actually, in my 16 years, I have witnessed three wars. And I see that this was the worst, because it was my first time to feel unsafe all the time, because in the previous two wars, I was sure that I won't be targeted because I'm an innocent civilian, but in this war it was against civilians. So I felt like I can be targeted at any moment, and especially because I show the world the truth about Israel on Twitter.
So, Ahmed, you know, the Amnesty International reports talked about the need following the conflict for things like the water shortages and lack of access to clean water to be addressed. The blockade had to be eased to allow humanitarian supplies and building materials. And I wonder, during your travels after the conflict, the extent to which those things were being recognized and honored. If you can share your perspective on that and what you found out.
Well, I hope so, but it's not, actually. I mean, still there's a shortage of water, shortage of power, and people stuck and can't move from place to place. Unfortunately, we are back to the point where really we need to fix those things again. And it seems like Gaza is under, you know, it's in between the Egyptian border, which is totally closed, and the Israeli checkpoints, which is totally, you know, closed. They open it for sometimes for whatever, you know, reasons and permits and stuff like this. So it's not really open for everybody and for all the people. So there is a lot of need in Gaza in terms of those issues like freedom of movement, power supply, clean water, and basic needs. And when we talk about population living, 2 million people living in that place and denied, I mean, freedom of movement, denied a good nice clean water, denied power supplies like other cities and other area, which is really, it put them in a way under deep frustration. And unfortunately, they are not promoting much more peace and these kind of condition and not promoting openness. It's just segregate 2 million people and put them in the corner. And you left them with this kind of a blockade, which has lasted for the last 7 to 8 years, and they don't have any options. I know a lot of young guys just graduate from high schools, and they come to me, ask me to help them to go to have a better education somewhere else. But the main problem is how they can get out of Gaza. You know, this is really a big deal for the people, like just normal students. They want to go study abroad. They can't. And some other, even people who are working over, for example, some other part of the world, like in the Persian Gulf areas or working in, they're stuck in Gaza. They can't go back to their own works. So still the people of Gaza, and I'm talking about like the population, the people, the civilians, is still denied all kind of freedom, and on top of that, the freedom of movement.
So I think probably we're getting close to the break there, are we, Jim, in terms of needing to take a station break?
No, we still have a few minutes, Gordon.
Okay, yeah? So what I was thinking, if we've got a couple minutes, you know, it's a pretty cold time of year here in Saskatchewan and Canada. What is the climate like right now in Gaza, and how would people who are, you know, who have had their homes destroyed and everything getting by in terms of the weather and everything else there, what's the climate like there right now?
Yeah, in Gaza, there's 92,000 family lost their own homes in the last assault on Gaza. And those families still waiting for their own house to be rebuilt, or looking for shelter here in the schools, or some of them, if they got some money, they rent a small unit to just, you know, to continue. And it's a big mess. And as you can see or listen through those some interviews I did on the video, that you will see how big that problem are. And unfortunately, I was talking to the European representative over that area, and the issue on the table that how they are not bringing the cement.
I was going to say.
We have a shortage of cement.
Building materials.
Building materials, because the Israelis have a lot of objection to letting the cement go inside. Mm-hmm. And there is some kind of way invented to distribute the cement by names and by whatever families and etc. And it's really not working, this kind of mechanism which is they create, because they want to You know, if you want to rebuild your house, those they have to, you have to have like whatever 6 tons of cement and 3 tons of steel and stuff like this. And it's this kind of mechanism is not really doing enough to the people to rebuild, and it's not, the process is not really fast enough to rebuild the destroyed houses. So really a big problem, especially in the winter time, where the temperature now is around, you know, 5 to 6, and sometimes it's just a zero. So
imagine,
especially these days, imagine how those people are really coping with this in a tent or in a shelter here and there, without even, you know, the shortage of power and
Well, everything is in short supply.
Definitely. Everything. Which is really make it miserable for the people.
Right. Well, we have got to the bottom of our the first half hour here. So we're going to pause, and we'll take a station break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the next. We have more audio from your video. And so we'll tee that up and listen to it, and then discuss what we've heard. So we'll be right back after this.
So, Ahmed, you know, you've been talking to us a little bit about how you're interested in encouraging people across Canada, but including Saskatchewan, to consider maybe trying to visit Gaza. Other people in, say, Toronto or Vancouver have done that. They've been part of some humanitarian work there. Maybe you could share your perspective on that and how people might accomplish that. They're doing it through some church groups, as I understand it, and other organizations.
Yeah, I met in Gaza and in Jerusalem. I met some Canadians from some other provinces like Newfoundland, Ontario, and BC, doing some work, like a volunteer work with community over there. They stayed there for 3 months, and they come back to Canada, talk about what they saw and how those kind of experience. And I mean, I know for sure that this time will be very beneficial to the Canadian society in a way that link the Canadian society to the real question over there and make some kind of people-to-people relation, which is, I do believe it's important, and it's important to promote more peace and coexistence. And, you know, once you bring your experience from the Holy Land, from Gaza, or from West Bank, or from Jerusalem, or from Bethlehem to the Canadian over here, it's more about you give them awareness, you educate them, you talk about your experience, you talk to your family and your friends. So I do believe there is a great impact on such a time and such missions, whatever you can call it, volunteer or just a community work or just going to fact-finding, investigating, meeting other groups and people. And I think in Saskatchewan, I was talking to some friends, and there is some interest in this. We're trying to set up something for people to go spend at least 6 weeks taking some you know, short courses and doing some community works and relate more to the situation from a real experience, from, you know, on the ground experience, and they can come back and talk about this experience with, you know, local Saskatchewan, which is, I do believe that Saskatchewan not involved much into those kind of topics. And I think we should do a little more to push this forward.
So, you know, just one of the things I was wondering about when you were talking is in terms of what sort of, if people were considering that, what skills they would perhaps need or the people in Gaza would need, but also things like language issues. Do people need to be concerned if their only language is English and might be considering going? Maybe you could share your thoughts on that. But, you know, just in terms of what is needed for the people of Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think English is a problem, actually, English, because everybody speaks English these days, so it's easy for the people over to understand the Canadian accent, too.
It's
an advantage. It's for the interest of, it's a credit for our guys here to go and it will be easy to communicate with the people because they understand English. More than 50% of the people actually understand and speaks English. So.
And in terms of particular, when you talk about encouraging people either from Saskatchewan or somewhere else to go, would it be a suggestion that it be people with particular skills or really people who just are committed to learning and sharing when they get home?
At least you have to get sense of, justice, sense of doing something with needy people in a way that, maybe you volunteer sometimes in some community organizations over there doing, helping, for example, certain groups in terms of kids or women's or people in need. So there are some organizations actually working on that field over there, and there is some church groups doing some community works and some aid works, and they send people over there to do to sit with the some villages in the West Bank, in Hebron, in Ramallah, and in Nablus. So I met some people who are really doing a very positive work over there.
It seems to me, too, though, Ahmed, that hopefully one of the things that might come of this is people that go there and see what is actually happening might be able to talk to their local MPs and possibly pass along this information that perhaps our government should have a slightly different focus than what they do at the moment. This is my own personal opinion, it seems to me that perhaps there's too much government support going to the Israeli side of the equation. And they don't seem to see the merits of the Palestinian Gaza side of the equation. And I think that if more people were aware of what the facts are there, hopefully this could change.
I think you are right, and also it's more into put the Canadian into the missions they've been into for a long time, like peacekeeping nation, doing a sort of justice work and community work, and I think this is really preferable by nations around the world.
So would this be a good time to listen to some of the voices that you were able to record? And Ahmed, there's a variety of people again in this second segment of interviews, and I think they're just amazing stories you were able to capture in terms of the information, and really appreciate your taking the time today. Just for our listeners, we've been speaking with Ahmed Sabawi, who is been to Gaza just last fall. He was there after the most recent conflict and has been working on a film, and we've been able to take some time and edit some of the interviews that he's done with people.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of them right now.
2008, Israeli troops entered the northern part of the Gaza Strip. And they stayed there for about 5 to 7 days, during which they killed about 101 civilians, including 36 children. And I think Israel did that as a rehearsal for other crimes that it had already planned to commit later on in the Gaza Strip.
Practically speaking, we are living the hell and we are facing the hell. And as if international law, international humanitarian law, is there for intellectuals or for academics, not for the people to live it on their skin.
Israel, I think the Israeli policy towards Gaza was a very stupid policy. And they made use of Hamas. I'm not Hamas, but I have been in Gaza for the whole my life. My son witnessed three wars. He's not Hamas. The majority of Gaza are not Hamas. The popularity of Hamas in Gaza is around 20%.
Figures say that more than 2,100 people were killed. More than 30% of them are children. Another 11,000 people were wounded. More than 30% of them, again, are children. Children were severely attacked. And when it comes to children, recent estimations made by the UNICEF reports say that about 370,000 children are in need for one sort of psychological intervention, specialized psychosocial intervention. And this estimate was based on the number of casualties and the children who live in neighborhoods or who live in families that were targeted severely.
Poverty is extremely high. Unemployment rate before the most recent war was already 45%, which is the official unemployment rate. It certainly underrepresents overall unemployment. And this is because of the blockade, because of the lack of access to markets and freedom of movement. So it's not that goods aren't available in the shop, it's that people are too poor to buy them.
This is not what we are saying. This is have been stated and said once and again by Amnesty International, by EuroMed Human Rights Network, by International Committee of Jurists, by the Human Rights Watch, and many other Palestinian-Israeli human rights organizations. Israel putting in this last war civilians in the eye of the storm. That's all what we are doing. I mean, document, report, and trying to bring accountable those who committed war crimes and crimes against humanity. What had happened here, unprecedented and unique war crimes, when you erase 74 families, when you bombard factories, when you bomb the electricity power station, when you bomb schools where refugees are sheltering, when you bomb the hospitals, when you bomb our twin towers, three towers in Gaza.
I mean, it's an enormous challenge here. So I work for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. We effectively manage four parallel government ministries in Gaza. 1.2 of the 1.8 million people here, so 70% of the population are Palestine refugees, so they're looking to us for service. So we're providing education to 240,000 students in 250 schools. We have a massive healthcare program. Right now, our focus is maintaining those programs and now dealing with the aftermath of the war, which has left probably 90,000 refugee families with damage or destruction of their homes. So there's an enormous task in just maintaining our regular programming and then now addressing with all of the additional need brought on by the conflict.
It's true, we are affronting a war from all kinds, military, economically, socially, psychologically, healthy, from all sides. And however, we're still standing, we still, I think, strong enough to confront any kind of challenges. It's not easy, it's really very scary. But we have to survive because it's our message on this war, in this life, is to continue surviving and living and to keep our children be happy and to live as well as all the children. So last feast, which finished last week, our children, and I saw the smile in all the children in Gaza.
We're not going to have a fourth war. It's not only the people in Gaza that cannot afford having a fourth war. All the world cannot afford this. Because this would mean that we are desperate about finding a solution. You know, I'm 41, and I was born with this conflict already there. I've seen today children that were born during the last war here in August. We cannot go on generation by generation. That's why I say we cannot just sit and wait. If we sit and wait, it will go on for another 40 years. We have to have action now.
Heart beats fast, colors and promises. How to be brave? How can I love when I'm afraid to fall? Watching you stand alone, all of my doubts suddenly goes away so fast.
The symbolism of Gaza, it's something unique. It's unique among the all the people all over the world. It's a unique, and even in the West Bank, there is such a relationship among Christians and Muslims and all over. But Gaza, it show up. It start from the beginning of the Christianity till today, giving these lessons of love.
Gaza was subjected to 3 wars in 5 years, where many people were killed, thousands were injured, thousands of houses were destroyed. Until now, the siege is still ongoing by Israel. There is a few facilitation by Egypt at the Rafah crossing. 2/3 of Gaza population are youth. Most of these youth have never been outside. Some 15 years ago, Gaza used to be a very open-minded place, liberal place, where people were living as they want. Now, Gaza was pushed by the siege into being more radical. There is a lot of frustration among the youth.
So, Ahmed, there's a lot of interesting voices that you were able to share and their stories. The people of Gaza who, as you said earlier, are students, adults, people who have lived through 3 wars now, 3 conflicts. But also you were able to capture the stories of people who are there for their international work. You mentioned Bob Turner with the United Nations Relief Agency. And also a representative of the European Parliament, and maybe you could share her name and also where she's from. But also, it was interesting to me, you know, there was an interview with somebody with the a priest with the Orthodox Church who has lived forever in Gaza. So maybe you can just share your thoughts about some of the interviews you did in that segment.
Yeah, I did meet the main priest of Gaza. Actually, he is the Greek Orthodox head of the church in Gaza, which is a 2,000-year-old church.
Wow.
And it's been since the early Christianity, actually. And he was a very interesting guy, and he did talk about his experience during the war, because the church and the cemetery belonged to the church, being hit by bombs, and actually the school nearby was hit, and he offered the people of other neighborhoods a shelter over in his church. He opened the church, he provide food, he give whatever he can, mm-hmm, to help the people during the war on Gaza. So they play an essential role in the last war, and he was really very popular at that time. And he was, as you can listen to him, he's a nice character. He's very into talking to the people, mm-hmm, and being with the people. And I also did interview a Canadian guy. His name is Bob Turner, Robert Turner from BC. He's like the head of government in Gaza, because he's in charge of the operation of United Nations Relief and Work Agency over in Gaza. And he actually, this agency is just providing services like schools and foods and shelters to close to 800,000 people over there. And he talked to me about his experience for the last 2.5 years. He's been sitting there.
Does the UN consider Gaza like one big refugee camp? Like, is that how they kind of look at it?
It's almost. it's Gaza as some of our some of the people I interviewed. Actually, Amnesty International defined that Gaza is just open air, you know, open air prison. You know,
mm-hmm.
So those kind of things. I mean, putting 2 million people on a small piece of land and just lock the door and mm-hmm. keep the key in your pocket. You open whenever you want and
right.
you close it whenever you want. You just dump some food and some medicine, and you leave them like that. This is the case where we have to act as an, you know, as an individual, as an international community, to ease and to leave the sanction and the blockade on Gaza. And back to your question, Gord, about some other nice character I met, the European Foreign Minister in charge for foreign policies, Federica Mogherini. She was in that shelter where I was filming and shooting, and I asked her one question about, so what are you guys doing? Are you waiting for the fourth war to come, or you have to act in some ways? And she was really touched by what she saw at that shelter, and she came out and told me about her experience, that she just met some people born in that recent war in Gaza, and herself, she born with the conflict. She's, as she said, she's 41 years old, and she born with the conflict. But she said, the world will not tolerate a fourth war in Gaza, because we have to act, and we should not let things just going on forever without putting an end to this kind of occupation and this kind of blockade. And this clearly, those kind of things stated by, most of the international community leader, like Ban Ki-moon and mm-hmm. the European Community and the European Commissioner and, everybody who's really in charge or involved in this political effort and, team to find a solution to this.
So when you were there, you obviously would have, and maybe this is when you were interviewing the representative of the European Parliament, but you were visiting hospitals as well?
Oh, I mean, the hospitals in Gaza, now, the capacity to bring all these kind of wounded and heart cases is limited. There's mm-hmm. no space.
Mm-hmm.
So, I know for sure, and I have numbers, during the war they transfer most of the cases outside, trying to, to coordinate through the Red Cross and through some other international organization to send them to hospitals in Jerusalem and Ramallah, some of them in Turkey, another in Jordan, some of them in the hospitals in neighboring countries. So it was really very hard to mm-hmm. and some of those cases really you can't deal with in a local Gaza hospital.
Mm-hmm. And the schools, you were visiting schools as well. Many of them were actually shelters and were bombed as well.
Yes, schools across Gaza Strip, actually from the northern part to the southern part, from Jabalia and Beit Hanun area to Rafah area, has been just shelters for displaced people and displaced families. And so the families just moved to the schools to have a place to stay, and they stayed there until now. Some of them until now they are in those shelters. And you know, the school year started, and those families got no place to go. So, I mean, UNRWA and other organizations working into solving this and finding alternative to those families. But the latest news is not really telling us good things about the whole mechanism of resettling and rebuilding and reopening the borders. Still, everything is still where we start. So, unfortunately, hope that the coming months will fast and ease the blockade, and at least, you know, people can breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Ahmed, for taking the time today and sharing your experience when you were traveling in Gaza. People can be in touch with you through your organization, Journalists for Justice, and encourage people to consider, if they're listening to the program, and to be in touch with Ahmed. And one of the most amazing things is at the end of your visit, you were also able to capture an interview with the senior representative of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon.
Yes, I did.
So we're going to listen to that.
Yeah, we'll listen to that right now, and then we'll close off the program. So here is Ban Ki-moon.
The mindless pattern of blockades, rockets, and destruction must stop. I'm committed to doing everything possible in my power to support political efforts to finally end the nearly half century of occupation.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."